Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our Editor-at-Large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, Jamie, we are talking Deadites with Evil Dead Rise, eco-activism with How to Blow Up a Pipeline, action comedy with Ghosted, and the re-release of a classic, well, actually two, with Alien Day on the 26th of April. Before we get on to those, though, what else have you been watching this week? What's been getting into your square eyes, Jamie Graham?
Every time I'm on this podcast, I always talk about the various little seasons I'm doing. I always give myself something like an actor or a director who I get obsessed with. And at the moment, I'm revisiting a lot of Hitchcock films. Just because it's been a few years and he's one of my favourite directors, which will come as no surprise, I imagine, to anyone. So it's been a few years. So I'm planning to do them all, which is, you know, a lot of films, including all his silent movies, get through them all eventually.
And are you going to do them in like a chronological order or genre? How are you doing it?
No, because my season started without me realizing I was doing it. I just fancied rewatching Psycho, and then I rewatched The Birds. So I kind of started 1960, 1962, and I just watched those, absolutely loved them as always. And then that gave me a bug. And I was just like, oh, I know, I'm going to rewatch all of Hitchcock's films. So if I had a thought about it before, I may have done it chronological and started with The Silence and worked up all the way through to Frenzy, the final film. But no, I'm just going to do it as
just
the
scattergun Hitchcock.
Yeah, as the mood takes me, which is quite nice in a way, rather than thinking, oh, I've got to watch Notorious tonight, you know, whether I'm in the mood for it or not, although I'll always be in the mood for Notorious. But yeah, whatever I fancy that night, I'm just going to stick it on. So I've been watching a lot of Hitchcock films. And then on TV, I binged The Night Agent this week, which has been on Netflix for quite a while, a few weeks. And I just started that, and it's just really entertaining. Complete ripoff of 24, like a lot of shows are. It's, you know, another of those kind of against the clock, you know, terrorist threat, blah, blah, blah. And a lot going on, lots of twists and turns, all a bit mad, a bit OTT, a bit unbelievable. But just great, cracking entertainment, which you can just watch one episode after the other. So I binge that in 2 or 3 days. So that's what I've been watching. What about you?
I have also been on Netflix watching Obsession, the saucy old limited series with Richard Armitage getting obsessed with his son's girlfriend, which is obviously a sort of remake adaptation of the Jeremy Irons, Juliette Binoche film Damage, which I have always loved in a sort of love to watch it because it's so terrible way. I really always enjoyed the way Jeremy Irons orgasmed in that film, like a distressed seagull. And the fact that pretty much all of their couplings are the least sexy thing you could ever watch, sort of frantically rutting against doors in Bruges and things. So this is an improvement on that, but it obviously has caught the Daily Mail's attention with some of its saucy scenes, its self-pleasuring and sniffing of hotel bedding in order to get off. I mean, we discussed this the last time we had a erotic thriller to discuss, which was the decidedly unerotic Ben Affleck, Ana de Armas, Deep Water.
Yeah.
I do like an erotic thriller.
I think we all do.
When it's done well and it is actually hot and sexy, it's a really brilliant genre. I mean, I love Fatal Attraction. It's right up there in my favourite films. So I am enjoying Obsession, even though it's being ridiculed by people.
Yeah, I think they're coming back slowly. You know, we've lived the last few years in quite sexless times in the cinema. And various reasons have been given for that. People have said, you know, is it Marvel with their kind of desexualized superheroes who are just like action figures, no genitals, that kind of thing? Or is it because porn is just a click away on the internet, so we no longer need that illicit thrill of seeing sexy people do things on our cinema screens? You know, we can go straight to it. You know, there's all these different theories, but whatever the truth of it is, I think people have missed it. Audiences have missed it. But a good erotic thriller, like we had in the 80s and early 90s, we had a lot of them. You know, they can be really entertaining on numerous levels. And I think we've seen two or three in the last year or so. And I think people are coming around to it. So hopefully we'll get a whole rash of them.
Yes. Well, not getting a rash from them, obviously, or any of them participating, getting any kind of rash. Safe sex, please.
Can I just give a shout out? Because you said about Jeremy Irons having an orgasm like a, what was, how did you say it? A seagull?
A distressed seagull. He goes,
yes. Well, in the new Ari Aster film, Beau is Afraid,
Yes.
there is a sex scene in that film between Parker Posey and Joaquin Phoenix where it's two of the greatest orgasms you've ever seen in cinema. That's all I'm saying. And they're both,
Wow.
you talking about a distressed seagull reminded me of them because it's kind of played a bit for laughs, but you won't forget those two orgasms, I promise you.
Wow, goodness. I'm also looking forward to, on the sort of orgasm note, The Idol, which we're seeing trailers for now, the new show that's coming in from the makers of Euphoria, had a sort of problematic thing going on with the fact that it's apparently been chaotic behind the scenes, and there's, a lot of discussion about how the feminist lens has been shifted away for this thing. And it's Lily Rose Depp as this young singer, sort of Britney Spears-esque person, who is sort of manipulated by Svengali, played by The Weeknd, and the various sort of machinations of the business. But it looks like the kind of TV that we're all going to be talking about and watching and saying, what do we think about that? How do we feel about that? How complicit do we feel in it? Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. So, yeah, more
Yeah.
sexy and raunchy, please, is what I'm saying.
Why not? We need something to talk about around the water cooler, don't we?
Indeed, if only we had a water cooler. We don't.
True.
We could talk about it around the fruit basket at work. How about that? The
Yeah,
very
we.
sad little wicker basket that has that if you don't get to it first thing in the morning, all the bananas are gone. Anything exotic like a plum disappeared, and all you've got is some bruised apples or a very unappealing hard pear.
Yeah, I mean, you talking about bananas and plums is kind of tying in quite nicely with the theme of this so far. So maybe we need to get off the subject. It's gone to my head.
Okay, shall we get on with it then for what we can watch
Yes.
this week? It's time to get dead bloody with this.
All you can do is run.
I'm getting this out of you.
You'd be a good mom someday, honey.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know how to lie to kids.
Mommy's with the maggots now.
So this is Evil Dead Rise. Jamie, you're an expert in this, somebody who enjoys the Evil Dead franchise, who has watched it numerous times. Tell us where this sits in the canon.
So this is a brand new entry in the Evil Dead franchise, the fifth movie we've had of Evil Dead. We've also had the Ash versus Evil Dead TV show, which was 3 seasons from 2015 to 2018 before it was cancelled. But this is the fifth movie and the first one since 2013 when Fede Alvarez did Evil Dead, which was a really quite sort of hardcore, gory, slightly torture porny kind of version of Evil Dead. Now, this one, what makes this one very, very different is it's the first one to move the action out of a cabin in the woods, which the original of the Evil Dead kind of started that whole subgenre in 1981, and all the films have been in a cabin in the woods. And this one moves the action to a kind of condemned high-rise apartment in Los Angeles. So it's still very much one location, but
You still
rather in a
do get a
cabin.
cabin in the woods, don't you, at the very beginning?
Right at the start, a little nod to the original trilogy. It starts in a cabin in the woods and it kind of ends in a cabin in the woods. There's a wraparound story, but that's very much just a playful nod and really entertaining. I love those scenes, they're great. But kind of 98% of the action is in a high-rise apartment in Los Angeles. And it's still really claustrophobic and it's a rundown building, dilapidated, all the lights flickering. You know, it's about to be. Kind of everyone has to get out and it's going to be condemned. But it's a very different setting to what we're used to. And in this high-rise apartment lives single mother Ellie, played by Alyssa Sutherland, and her 3 children. And the movie starts with Ellie's sister, Beth, who's a kind of estranged sister. She turns up as usual because she needs a little bit of help, but she's facing a kind of a dilemma or something she needs to talk about. So she turns up, and no sooner has she turned up than there's an earthquake, which conveniently kind of cracks open the garage floor under this apartment block. And it was built, the apartment block was built on a bank, and in the bank vault is a Book of the Dead, which anyone from who knows the Evil Dead films will know that that is what sets off all the action. It's a kind of skin-bound book written in blood, and when it's opened, then it unleashes hell, a demonic force, and then the family kind of is taken over and it goes from there.
Yes. Now, if you like Evil Dead, which you do, is this a good entry into this series?
It is really good. It is the best Evil Dead film since Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn in 1987. It's just, it really, really gets the tone right. That on the one hand, it's very, very gory and extreme, but it's done in a way like Evil Dead 2, for example, where it's kind of tongue-in-cheek and the splatter is so much, but it's got a really comical, fun element to it. You don't feel you're watching Eli Roth, you know, kind of looking through your fingers like in absolute agony as all this blood hits the wall. You're kind of laughing along with it, but it's almost cartoonish in places that it's so over the top, especially the last 20 minutes. But where it also feels like a modern horror movie and it succeeds is I think the characters are stronger than we normally get in an Evil Dead film. They're a bit more fleshed out, the family dynamic, the kind of dynamic between these two sisters. There's a theme of motherhood in the film and sort of fractured family, and it kind of combines the best of both worlds. It's directed by a young director called Lee Cronin, who did A Hole in the Ground. That was his debut, which again dealt with sort of mothers, daughters, and was a kind of, I hate this phrase, but an elevated horror movie. Really, really good film. And this is his kind of next movie, Big Leap. And he really does it justice that he is a big fan of the Evil Dead films. He grew up with them. He watched the first two when he was about 8 years old. His dad.
Oh, that's not, dearie me. That's a bit too young for that sort of content, isn't it?
Well, I watched Friday the 13th Part 2 when I was eight, and it never did me any harm, Jane, as I'm sure you will testify.
Debatable.
No, well, anyway, his dad sat him down when he was 8 years old, and he watched these films, so they're really in his DNA. So he's a good choice to do it, and he's come in, and honestly, there's knives, there's scissors, there's shards of glass, there's a fantastic use of a cheese grater, which, oh my God, it's awful. All Evil Dead fans will be glad to know that a chainsaw makes an appearance, which, of course, is a vital part of the films. And it's just great. It's kind of just, you come out with a big grin on your face that bits of it are sort of nasty in a body horror kind of way, like chewing a glass that really sort of gets you. But most of the blood, like I say, is really sort of over the top and comical. And there's 6,500 litres of blood they used in this film. And
which you
it's
will
all
see
up there
in
the
a
screen.
Nod to another filmmaker that
you
involves
will
a lift.
There is a fantastic elevator scene involving a hell of a lot of blood, which, yeah, The Shining obviously springs to mind. But, you know, it's great. I mean, an example of how good this film is it was originally being made to screen on HBO Max, and then they tested it with audiences and it tested through the roof and everyone absolutely loved it. So they decided to put it into cinemas, and, you know, it's just a great choice. Like, it premiered at South by Southwest Festival, again, went down a storm. And I think Evil Dead fans, and just fans, are good Friday night entertainment who sort of want to be scared and have a laugh and just have a great sort of, where you come out with your heart racing, that kind of horror movie. They're going to love it.
Yeah. Or you Go could on. Say that it was, you know, relentless, pointless, and just don't understand why we've had to have another one. I mean, it's a, as you say, it's a very accomplished way of doing this franchise again. It's done well, if that's what you like, but it just felt to me like it was, I've seen it all before. Since obviously The Evil Dead, we've had J-horror and all sorts of things that have influenced, you know, how we view something as creepy, and the sort of disjointed woman crawling out of a bath, a bit damp, and all of this sort of thing. It felt like nothing was particularly original. It didn't feel like watching Hereditary, for example, that chilled me to the bone and got me in a way that, like, The Exorcist did, or other things like that, that really managed to mine something deep and dark within me. This just felt extremely surface and light. And as you say, if you're into that, and if you really like Evil Dead, and if you really enjoy a sort of a popcorn horror, that's what it's doing, and tick, that is what it's going to do. But I feel like maybe at this stage in the evolution of horror films and where we are and what we can do with them, I want a little bit more. I mean, there is, as you mentioned, there's this motherhood theme. And I thought it was quite an interesting sort of treatise on the absolute horror of if you're unprepared to be pregnant and unprepared to be a mother, and the horror that could instill in a woman of how will I deal with this? And it is essentially, sometimes for some people, the equivalent of being faced with an undead horde of horrors coming at you like, I have no idea how I'm equipped to deal with this. I have no knowledge of what this is going to be like. And it feels as though being inhabited by something isn't of you, a succubant inside you, perhaps, for some people. So I liked that play with the film. And also I find it really difficult when people don't sort of talk about their phones. I mean, obviously, you know, like with this, it's like, oh, the earthquake's taken all the signals out, so that dealt with that. But then when they don't, it's like these people haven't seen a horror film. So it's like, you know, and like, oh, don't go in there. Please don't go in there. When you found that book, abso-flipping-lutely don't touch that thing. No, it's got teeth on its spine. I think we all would know exactly what not to do with that. So that sort of thing I thought was not as elegantly handled as the rest of it. Also, Jamie, as an expert, I don't remember them levitating, which they do in this.
No, they do levitate. And I mean, in stuff like Evil Dead 2, it really goes bonkers that Sam Raimi, far more than this one, he kind of throws the camera around and all the furniture comes to life and starts chattering. And, it's really sort of hallucinatory kind of pyrotechnic horror. And this one doesn't go to those extremes, but it does do a few new things. Like you mentioned J-horror just then. I think this one is quite influenced by J-horror in the way the Deadites now move, that they're very sort of clacky and limbs bending and contorting in the wrong way and all of that. I mean, everything I liked about it is what you are sort of saying you didn't like about it, which I fully understand. But I love serious horror films with great subtext that have something to say about the world. And, you know, that's not just elevated horror, as they call it now. It goes right back to the start of a genre. It's always been there. And I love those films. But I also love films like this where, you know, it's not there to really say something. There's the motherhood theme, but its main reason for existing is entertainment. It's just to go in and have a great Friday night with loads of kind of visceral, inventive gore, coming up with different ways to kill people. The Deadites in this are a lot of fun again, which they weren't in the 2013 version. This one, it goes back to the originals, that they're always kind of chattering and taunting and tormenting. And, you know, there's a certain amount of humour that comes with them. And I just found it a wild ride, you know, that I love the start of it. I felt it dipped a little bit in the middle. And then the last 20, 30 minutes were so exhilarating and so over the top that I just walked out into the night absolutely beaming. And I think if you just want a good Friday night horror movie, and if you're an Evil Dead fan particularly, this one will give you a lot to chew on, that you'll really enjoy it.
Oh, a lot to chew on. I see what you've done there. Okay, so I'm going to say proceed with caution if you're not, like, if you're sort of just looking for fun this weekend. I think there's possibly other films that might be better suited. But yeah, you know, if you like a drenching of blood, you're certainly going to get buckets of that in this. Very, very bloody and very good use of a tree equipment. Say no more what it actually is, but there is a tree. There's some tree pruning equipment that's used to great effect.
There's some lovely little nods to the originals as well. Sam Raimi's, like you mentioned, the opening scene, you know, takes place in a cabin, but it starts with this big swooping camera move, which is very, very Sam Raimi. You think, here we go, it's Evil Dead. Then it turns out to be a drone, you know, a drone shot. And then the rest of the movie isn't necessarily like that, that, you know, Lee Cronin's camera isn't as kind of gymnastic as Raimi's. But that's great because, you know, we don't want him to just copy Sam Raimi. He's got his own style and he's a very good director. You know, he's got a lot of ability. He knows what he's doing. But he, at the same time as doing his own thing, he does capture the DNA of the original franchise. So I'm all for it.
Okay, so if you fancy the Evil Dead rise, and they do rise out of lakes and all sorts of other horrible places, it's in cinemas on Friday. And it is worth seeing on a big screen. You know, you want to get enough splatter going on there, don't you? You're going to miss that if you wait for a smaller. So shall we move on then from Deadites to Acolytes? It's this.
We have to show how vulnerable the oil industry is by hitting something big.
Michael, what do you think the odds are we blow ourselves up?
I don't really care.
So this is How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which is based on a book, not a true story. It is a narrative that has been invented, but nonetheless is about true world events. Jamie, tell us, who's trying to blow up which pipeline?
So yeah, I mean, this movie does what it says on the tin, really, that it's a group of environmental activists who come together from all over America. They're all sort of pretty young, ragtag crew of people, all different backgrounds, different reasons for being activists. And they come together and decide to implement real change, that they've had enough of just talking about things and protesting things and nothing ever happening. So they decide to blow up a pipeline in West Texas. By doing this, it would mean the oil company can't move or sell their oil for a number of weeks. It would tank the stock prices. You know, it would really do instant change. And their argument is that, you know, it isn't a time for incremental change, that you can go on and on about doing things by the law in a law-abiding or peaceful way. But with climate change, which is such a ticking clock, you know, we haven't got years and years and years to implement change. So they want to do something drastic, which means damaging property, which means being unlawful. But they feel they're fully in the right because the law is wrong on this one.
So they do reference that they are following in the footsteps of other activists in history, like the Boston Tea Party or anyone who have taken a legal action in order to affect real change, and that this is the sort of the point at which they have to do it. But they play this like a sort of really tense thriller, don't they?
They do. This is what is very clever about this film, that, like you said, it's based on a book, Andreas Malm's Eco Manifesto. And you'd kind of think the natural way of doing this as a film would be to do a documentary. But rather than do that, what they do is they make a film that is essentially a heist movie, but without a heist. You know, it's about these people coming together. You know, it's a procedural movie that they're working out how to go about what they're going to do. They're sort of learning how to build bombs, you know, when is the best time to set the bomb, where they're going to do it, how they're going to get away with it, how they're going to do the maximum damage without kind of drowning the landscape in oil. They have to find somewhere they can blow up the pipeline without flooding the area and causing damage. It's got this real kind of propulsive element to it that you really feel you're watching a heist movie. And what is also very clever about it is it has a time hopping structure where every time you're just getting into it and getting swept away in it, it suddenly focuses on a different character and sort of jumps back in time, and you learn about this particular character and what their background is and why they're an activist and why they want to do this. And, you know, you'd think by keep doing that, because there's a lot of characters to get through, you'd think that it would lose its momentum, that it would be really haphazard and jumbled and fractured. But somehow they do it in such a way that it's still really exciting. And when you snap back to the present day action, you know, it's still got all the momentum. And it's just a really good film that has something to say, that is politically engaged. You know, it's dangerous in a way. Some reviewers have called it dangerous, but dangerous in a good way. I think that this is a film where it's saying we've had enough. Something has to change. You know, action has to be taken. And you do get the counter arguments. You get various parents, friends, you know, people who don't believe in the cause, who give their point of why you shouldn't be doing this and you're terrorists and, like, you know, it's the wrong way to do it. But like you said, you know, they believe in it. They talk about the civil rights movement, about anti-apartheid, about suffragettes, you know, all these things where there has been action, you know, sort of violent action in a way, because sometimes if you're going to instigate change, you know, you have to do something like that. That's how they feel.
Yeah. It sort of reminded me of Reservoir Dogs, in that sort of the way this sort of filmmaker and this relative unknown faces have come together, and we really get to know them in a really short period of time, the running of this film, and really feel for them and understand their motives. But at the same time, it's incredibly like, you know, dry mouth, kind of clenching your fists, like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And also then this, not to give anything away, but there's an ending that feels almost The Usual Suspects. So I don't use those two films lightly. Those are absolutely cracking films. But I think that this is on a par with them in terms of bravado and cleverness and just the absolute world building that is happening here, and the absolute believability of it. I absolutely believed every single person in this film.
Where it's great, and you just touched upon it, believability, is that all of these young characters are relatable. But normally in Hollywood films, when you're dealing with people who are kind of extreme kind of environmental types, you know, they very much focus on the extreme and they make them out to be almost sort of a bit nutcasey or badass, or, you know, in films like Quantum of Solace or something, it's always with a slight negative light. Whereas this film, it's really people you believe that you've met, you know, and they're just normal people who, you know, have beliefs and normal lives, and you like them and you feel for them and you kind of get with them to a certain degree. And I think it's really cleverly done.
It's also people who have something to lose. These are not people, they feel like they have no choice but to do this. And they understand what the consequences could be of that and will be of that. You know, you will be facing jail time. You're essentially blowing up your own life as well as a pipeline when you do this. And so from that point of view, it's really well sort of sketched as well. The idea that nobody's going into this thinking that they're going to run off like superheroes and having, you know, completed the heist and off you go and disappear, that this is something that is an incredibly dangerous thing to do for them personally as well. So I love that as well. Yeah. But and you know, I loved Lucas Gage in this. He plays this sort of quite daffy, surfy guy who's always, you know, wanting to get a blowjob rather than actually look at his watch whilst he's trying to undertake his part of the plan. But he's, again, I just really felt for him. And there's a particular scene where he breaks down and cries and his sort of bravado and his bro persona breaks down a little bit. And you realize just how much is at risk for these people. Yeah, loved it. Thought it was absolutely cracking. We gave it 5 stars in the magazine, and I think deservedly so.
And also, they all come from different walks of life. You know, you've got a Native American who hates the fact that oil companies are stealing his land. You've got a couple of people who come from an oil refinery town where one of them is very ill because of what's going on there. You've got an ex-serviceman. You know, they've all got their own reasons for doing it. And the young cast are terrific. But a lot of the faces you may recognise and not quite sure where from. You've mentioned Lucas Gage, who's Euphoria. You've also got Sasha Lane, who was so fantastic in American Honey, which is one of my favourite films of recent years. I think it's absolutely great. And yeah, it's just a really dynamic, kind of propulsive film where, you know, normally movies like this, they can be a bit dry and they can be didactic, but you don't get that at all with this. Again, talking of Friday night entertainment, like we did with Evil Dead, you could go to a multiplex, watch this on a Friday night, and you'll get a lot out of it, but you also get a great deal of entertainment.
Yes. And also, interestingly, it doesn't really necessarily judge them either way, the film. It asks you just to take a look at them and contemplate them and understand them, not necessarily to jump in with them or against them, which I think is a really delicate balance to be able to do an issues film. I'm doing quote marks that isn't heavily either one way or the other. It is asking all of us as audience members to say, what do we do? Can we have a conversation? Can we all get into a conversation about this? What is the right way? Is there a right way? Can we work together on it? Which I think is pretty masterful in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really catches that younger generation, that they're the ones who need the change and want the change and are going to hopefully instigate the change, because this is the earth that they are inheriting and it's dying and they have to do something. So, you know, I hope it reaches that generation, that people who are kind of in their teenage years would go out and watch this, because, you know, it's really great.
Yeah. It's about taking responsibility as a community, as a society, and thinking how we move forward. So, yeah, it's really good. So that is How to Blow Up a Pipeline. It's out in cinemas on Friday. Highly recommend. So, do we want to stay on an explosive theme? Let's go with this.
Get it. It's a grand romantic gesture.
Yeah, that is amazing, mate. 5,000 miles to surprise a girl who you've only met once, especially if she's the one who ghosted you.
No, no, she didn't ghost me. She just doesn't have an international calling plan.
Oh, right.
Where am I?
Oh, God. You have the wrong guy?
I'm a farmer.
Wait.
Can you walk, Cole?
Sadie.
So this is Ghosted. It's a Chris Evans produced action comedy starring him and his Knives Out co-star Ana de Armas. Jamie, what's going on between these two? Who's ghosting whom?
So it is Sadie, played by Ana de Armas, who's ghosting Cole, who's played by Chris Evans. And what happens is they initially meet at a market stall, of all places. Cole is a farmer and he is chatting to Sadie, who he believes is an art curator at this point, that they have a little flirt at the market stall. And then they kind of fall out. But there was a real spark between them. So as Sadie goes off to her car, leaving in a bit of a mood, Cole basically chases after her and begs her to go on a date with him. And they go out for a date that lasts all night. But they're just like out walking in Georgetown in Washington. They go and have some karaoke. It's a lovely meet cute. They get on brilliantly. They have a wonderful date that winds up the next morning back at her flat in her bed. Everything seems great. And then she ghosts him and he's texting her. No reply. So he decides he can't believe he's being ghosted, and he knows that she's going to London the next day or, you know, the next week. So he decides that he will surprise her and fly over to London in what he believes is a grand romantic gesture and just turn up and say, yeah, here I am. And they can carry on where they left off. Of course, when he turns up in London, A, she thinks it's all a bit stalkery and what the hell are you doing here? And B, it turns out that she is a secret agent. She is on a very, very dangerous mission, and he has just landed himself plumb in the middle of it and now has to go along for a very, very dangerous ride.
Now, this was an idea that was sort of conceived by the team behind Deadpool.
Yeah.
And has been executed by Dexter Fletcher as director. As we said, Evans is producing it. There are some cameos from those two worlds, from Evans' worlds and the Deadpool world, that make their way into here. Is it as fun as a Deadpool film? Is it something you want to... No.
No, basically. It's not as fun as it sounds as well, that, you know, it's basically trying to be a modern day Romance in the Stone with a gender flip. But the clever idea to it is that Ana de Armas, she's the character who is super capable and a secret agent and brilliant with all weapons and fighting and can kind of kick ass and get herself out of any situation. And he is the one who's completely useless and being dragged along after her and squealing and afraid. And, you know, it's a nice little gender flip, and that's the idea. And then the whole time they're in danger, being shot at in car chases, all of that malarkey. There's a kind of battle of the sexes going on, that they're constantly bickering and bantering, and there's lots of quips, and, you know, it's kind of prattle of the sexes action comedy. Now, that all sounds great fun, especially when you've got Captain America playing the guy who's completely useless. And you've got Ana de Armas, who we all know from the Bond film, No Time to Die. She
Paloma.
Absolutely, oh my God, that scene, she was wonderful. You know, so capable. So the idea of her doing all these action stunts and being in all these set pieces, it just sounds tremendous. And for some reason, it just doesn't quite work. Their kind of chemistry, their spark is
zero.
Fine. Do you think it's zero? I think it's fine, not as much as you'd want it to be, but I think they're sort of one of the better things about the film. My problem with it was all of the set pieces just felt really kind of, we've seen them all before, and they kind of hit the marks at best, but there's nothing particularly exciting or fluent or original. in them. You know, it's not like watching James Cameron, an action master, you know, Dexter Fletcher. I actually like the films he's done up to this point. He did Rocket Man, of course, before this, Sunshine on Leaf. You know, I think he's good, but almost with this, it's like he's bitten off a bit more than he can chew. It just felt a bit flat to me. And the other thing that completely ruined it for me is just the amount of reliance on CGI in all the action scenes that, you know, we all watched Top Gun Maverick last year, you know, and
Well, let's not pretend there wasn't CGI in that. There was.
Yeah, there was, of course there was, but there was also an awful lot of done for real stunts. And you really get that sense of peril. You get the sense of people being up in the air in the jets, you know, zooming along, and it just feels dangerous and exhilarating. And you can always sense it when they do something for real. And on this, it's so heavily CGI'd that to me, so much of the backgrounds and, you know, what was going on felt fake. You know, when they're zooming along cliff tops and the jeeps hanging over the edge and people are leaning out windows, I just never for a moment felt excited or scared. You know, no one felt in peril. It just felt completely green screen
Yeah, I
and,
mean the
you
one I
know,
think the one
lost
you're
me.
talking about is one where a sort of Pakistan Khyber Pass bus is
Yes,
driven
Khyber Pass.
backwards down a cliff road,
Yeah.
and it feels in no way like anybody has ever been to Pakistan, the Khyber Pass, or even a bus in that.
No.
And also then within that scene, there's this very weird decision to reference Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is just like in the middle of this, where there isn't particularly landing, you've decided to reference an immense action sequence in the desert that is far superior and is many decades older. Yeah, it's really strange. As you say, flat, I think, is the right word for it. It's not that it's terrible, it's just that it doesn't zing, does it?
No, it
And
doesn't mean.
so, you know, if we're talking about it in terms of dates, you know, those two have a date, it's not one that you would be bothered about calling them the next day over.
No, not really. But I mean, you mentioned Indiana Jones there. It's noticeable with that. Like the first indie movie has got so much great action, you know, exhilarating action. And then you jump forward to the fourth one, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And when they start bringing in the heavy CGI with some of the jeep chases and swinging through the jungle and the ants and all of that, again, it felt fake and it just wasn't great. And I get the fact that modern day films, that they have to look after their stars, you know, the insurance, the modern day safety rules. They wouldn't allow you to do a lot of the stuff that they used to in old school when you had Sam Peckinpah and people shouting through the bullhorn, you know,
Yeah.
John Ford making you
Get
do
off the
crazy
horse.
stunts. Yeah, you know, where anyone could die at any moment. I get that they have to do it differently, but why modern day films lean so heavily into it, you know, when the best is to get a nice balance, to do everything you can practical, and then when you have to sort of augment it with CGI, then by all means do it. But so many productions just seems to want to do it all CGI.
Yeah, this sort of is in the vein of The Gray Man, which also starred Ana de Armas and Chris Evans. So yeah, if you were into that, this will probably do the trick. It's perfectly fine to watch whilst you're eating your curry. But yeah, it's just a shame, isn't it, that these two very charismatic, very capable people, who I think probably could do their stunts perfectly well without all of that shenanigans going on, as we've seen them do in other films. It's just a shame that it doesn't quite get to the level you want it to. I mean, Anna, love her, but you know, it's no deep water. We're not going that far away
No,
from it being one
it's
of them.
not.
But I just feel like I'm hoping for more from Ballerina. She's obviously in Ballerina, the John Wick offshoot. If you want to see what Ana de Armas can do action-wise, then you're going to get a taste of it here. But I think probably you're going to see the best of what she can do in Ballerina, not in this film.
I think the fact it's on a streaming service, it's Apple Plus, is its saving grace. Because, like you said, it's the kind of film that if I just sat down on a Friday night with a takeaway, I'll stick it on for free, or it feels like free, you know, when it's on a streaming service because you've already paid your fee. I'd stick it on and it'd be like, yeah, that wasn't very good, but it sort of diverted me for a couple of hours, you know, it's fine. But if I went out, if I sort of put aside a whole evening to go out into town, into a cinema, you know, paid my money, sat in a cinema, I would come out really sorely disappointed.
Yeah. And also, it's a shame that their sort of zing together isn't more palpable. People keep telling them that they're sexual chemistry is electric and they should get a room. And it's like, what are you seeing? What are you, Mrs. Stallholder at the market, seeing that I'm not? Because it's not transferring to the audience, as far as I was concerned. I didn't think that they were attracted to each other, let alone like destined for each other. And honestly, if we're going to talk about a Romancing the Stone update that was successful, The Lost City did that already really quite well.
Did it a lot better. Sorry, yeah, it did do it a lot better than this. And there's two running gags in Ghosted. One is the one that you said, where every single person they meet is sort of saying, oh, you two should get a room, because they're constantly prattling at each other. And the other one is that different bounty hunters pop up, you know, every 10 minutes, because there's a fee on their heads. And so there's always bounty hunters popping up, and every single one is a very famous person. And I'm not going to say who they are, but that's kind of mildly amusing. But that's about as good as it gets. Now, what would be interesting is if they make Ghosted 2, because this ends in such a way that it's very much left all the doors open for the next adventure, and they obviously want a franchise for it. Now, let's see if that happens.
Yeah, perhaps a second one might actually be better, because they've bedded in that relationship. And so going into another film, we just accept that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, and that they were attracted without having to fight that constant disbelief of it. So maybe it would sit better if we join their adventures again. Who knows? And also, they're a little bit busy, those two. They might not have the time in their schedule to get together for another one of these, but we'll see. So are we recommending Ghosted that's on Apple TV Plus from Friday?
I'm not recommending it, no.
I'm saying don't get the streaming service if you haven't already to get this. There's other things coming up that I think you'll want to pay for. If you've already got it, get a takeaway, enjoy it, never think of it again.
Yeah, I can go with that.
Okay, let's move on then to our final film or films of the week, because in space, no one can hear you scream.
What's it got down his throat?
I would suggest it's feeding him oxygen.
Paralyzes him, puts him in a coma. And keeps him alive. Now, what the hell is that? Well, we gotta get it off him.
Just a minute. I mean, let's not be too hasty. We don't know anything about it. Now, we're assuming it's feeding him oxygen. If we remove it, could kill him.
So, Jamie, this is Alien, Ridley Scott masterpiece. It's being re-released in cinemas on the 26th of April. Obviously, you can watch Alien and Aliens by James Cameron on other formats. Why see it on the big screen?
Just because they're two of the greatest movies ever made. Simple as that. And so iconic and influential. And we should probably say a little bit about why they're being re-released, because it's Alien Day, which has been, for people who don't know, it's been running since 2016, but every year on April the 26th. And they chose that day because the planet where there's, you know, one of the first planets the Xenomorphs were discovered on was LV-426. So they take the 426, and that's 26th of April. So every 26th of April, they have an Alien Day where all sorts of collectibles are released, and novels and comic books and clothing and merchandise. And, you know, it's just become a big celebration, like we have Star Wars Day every year. But this year, Park Circus have re-released Alien and Aliens, I believe for one night only on the 26th of April, onto the big screen. And a lot of cinemas around the country are showing them as a double bill. So it lasts about 4.5 hours to see the two.
Yeah,
I fully recommend it. I've actually got my ticket that I'm going on the 26th of April to my local to watch Alien and Aliens.
Yeah.
Two films that I've seen many, many times before. I've seen the original Alien on the big screen once before. I haven't seen the Aliens. But films like this, it's where they belong. You know, you're up in space, completely immersive on the big screen. You know, that famous tagline, in space, no one can hear you scream. You will feel that, you know, like you don't at home watching it on a, you know, even if you've got a 60-inch TV screen and great sound system, you don't feel it like you do in the cinema. So I would say get along. You know, the first one is one of the great horror science fiction films. Very scary, creepy, essentially a haunted house / slasher movie in space. And then the second one, of course, James Cameron, up the ante, turned it into an all-out balls-to-the-wall action movie. Put the S onto Alien, plural aliens, because they're everywhere. And it's just one of the great action movies. You know, to this day, people are constantly aping it. You see its influence in so many movies, and no one ever gets close, or very, very rarely do they get close. So, you know, get along and see them. Please do.
And also, it gives us Sigourney Weaver in this absolutely iconic role as Ripley, in her little vest and pants that she wakes up out of a pod, which... it's a little bit sort of camera angles there, but you know, that girl in her bra and pants is going to kick some serious ass and is going to influence entire generations of characters and girls into being capable women, and create an amazing career for Sigourney Weaver. She's in The Master Gardener coming up, still amazing, still just really corking female roles that she plays. Yeah. And this is just one that, if you've never seen it, it's worthy of seeing just from a cultural touch point. And if you have, as you say, to see it on a big screen with proper surround sound, where, you know, your washing machine's not going to finish and make you pause whilst you go and get your pants out, or whatever it is that happens at home, I think it's a really special experience and a wonderful opportunity, and to see them back to back, because you might not often sit down to do that at home. I know you would, Jamie, but you're not normal.
No, I'm not.
Most people will watch a film and then they might watch the next one the next night. Most people don't actually devote the time to immersing themselves in a world like this. So what a treat to be able to watch both together.
The whole Sigourney thing you mentioned, you know, maybe if we've got younger listeners listening to this, you know, maybe they don't realise just how important she was, that Ripley in the original Alien was first of all written as a man and they gender flipped it. I think it was actually Ridley Scott who came on board and gender flipped it. And it was the first time we'd seen a female action hero like that, who just kicked ass and was so courageous and resourceful. And then Aliens, where you've also got the kind of mother subtext as well.
Yeah.
And she's both tough and, you know, it kind of balances every side of womanhood in a way. And she received an Oscar nomination for that in 1987. And that was just unheard of, for the Academy to give an Oscar nomination to a kind of a genre film, you know, best actress for a nomination for a genre film. It was unheard of. Even Sigourney Weaver, we've actually got her as a Total Film interview in the next issue of Total Film. And she's looking back on it now and she's saying that she couldn't believe it. You know, it was such a surprise and such an honour to be nominated. But like you said, Jane, it is kind of influenced and set the bar for so much that has come since. You know, if you love Mad Max Fury Road and Furiosa in that, you know, that wouldn't be there without...
Or even in Evil Dead Rise, you know, there's Beth and her protection of a child against this monster is a reflection of what Ripley had to do in Aliens. So, yeah, and also let's talk about the creature features. I mean, this was at the time as well, amazing special effects, the things that they did with, you know, the chest burst out of John Hurt's prone body as this horrible thing comes out. The actual alien design itself, you know, based on H.R. Giger's designs, just really stunning work. Whatever part of cinema and filmmaking you enjoy, whether that's production design, music, cinematography, acting, all of those elements are just perfection in these films.
Yeah, I mean, the only sort of slight negative I'd give is in the original Alien, when we finally kind of see the creature at the end, it is very much man in the suit. Just those final scenes, because it does that great thing that a lot of great horror films do, that it kind of hides the monster. Yeah. For most of the film, you just get glimpses and it's all about atmosphere and flashes and tension, and it's brilliantly done. It's one of the best at it. And then in the last sort of 10 minutes, the final kind of a showdown, you get to see it, and it's a little bit man in the suit. And I think they kind of corrected that by Aliens. Technology had moved on by then, but even so, I mean, that's just the smallest little thing to say that, but it is without doubt a masterpiece film, you know, copper bottom, five-star classic film, one of the great science fiction stroke horror movies. You know, please go and see it.
Okay, so Alien and Aliens is on Aliens Day, available on a big screen on the 26th of April.
Seven. Six.
Can't be, that's inside the room.
It's reading right, man, look.
Well, you're not reading it right.
5 meters, man. 4. What the hell? Oh, my God.
Oh, shit. Give me the light.
Right, Jamie, of that little lot, what's your film of the week? I think I can guess.
Can you? What are you guessing?
I think it's got to be Evil Dead Rises, you old horror nerd.
It is for me. I'm just about going to give it, I mean, very, very closely sort of contended by How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which I'm sure would be your favourite, but I would give it to Evil Dead Rise.
I would give it to How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I just think it's a film that you're probably going to say about that director, oh, yeah, you know, I knew I'd seen something special when I saw that film the first time. So go see it. Right. That is all we have time for this week. A reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you're all set. And also a reminder that a new issue is incoming, isn't it, Jamie? Next Thursday. We can't say what's going to be in it, but it's very good, isn't it, Jamie?
It's very, very good. I've given away one thing that's in it, but it's a belting issue. So please keep your eyes peeled for it.
Indeed. Okay. Before we go, though, we do have time for a listener's question. And this is what about Disney? It's Disney's centenary this year. They're 100 years old as a studio. What's your favourite Disney film?
Okay. Right, Jane, you know I can never give a straight answer.
No, it's going to be like, here's my top five with a caveat of 15.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people would just go blurt it out and that's the end of the question. But for me, I mean, what do we mean by greatest Disney film?
What's your favourite?
All right, what's
so
your
favourite? It's not objectively what's the greatest.
Okay.
So, you know, we're not doing the sight and sound poll of the greatest Disney. What is your favourite?
But are we saying, like, when I think a Disney film, I immediately think the great animated Disney movies. So are we saying that, or are we saying any film released by Disney, including all the Marvel films? Pixar films.
Jamie, stop making it complicated. If we're going for what the studio was originally conceived for, and it's a 100-year anniversary of that. Obviously, now it's expanded to include Star Wars and Marvel. But originally, it was an animation studio. What is your favourite animation Disney film? Do you think we'll get an answer from you? Let's go.
So we kind of stuff like Parent Trap and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and The Lone Ranger.
You're filibustering.
Okay. Right. They wouldn't be it anyway. I'm just playing devil's advocate. My favourite animated Disney movie has changed over the years. Right now it would be Pinocchio, 1940, because I think it is so creepy and unnerving but kind of wonderful and magical. I love it all. And much as I love Guillermo del Toro's version, which came out last year, which I thought was great, this is still for me the absolute pinnacle of Pinocchio adaptations. There have been many over the years. When I was a kid, my favourite was Jungle Book, but right now it would be Pinocchio.
Yeah, my favourite as a kid. Well, no, it wasn't my favourite as a kid. It was the one that haunted me and infected my brain. And I don't know that I actually liked it as a kid, but I do like it now, is Snow White. Because of the way the woods were, I went to see it on a big screen as a kid and was terrified when she goes into the woods and they have the eyes and all of the gnarled branches are reaching out and it's all dark and what's in the woods. And it's haunted me ever since. Obviously, if you look at it now, it's a little bit iffy with the seven dwarves and. But I do think they're quite charming if you take them for the time that they were created in and their little foibles that each of them have. And obviously, I love a good Disney baddie witchy queen, and she's great in that. I do like Sleeping Beauty as well, because I think Maleficent is a wonderful witchy queen as well. But I do think the queen in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is an absolute corker. So that would be my favourite.
I absolutely love the scene in Gremlins. When all the gremlins are watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and they're all singing along like, hey ho, and they're all rocking from side to side with their popcorn swinging off the chandeliers. But also, just final thing on Disney as well, We should also remember that Disney have now bought Fox. So
yeah.
You could say the greatest Disney film ever is something like Die Hard or MASH or French Connection or All About Eve or The Hustler. You know, they're all owned by Disney now. So if we can have one of those, I'd probably go one of those.
Yes, but that's an entirely different pod. That's a whole pod just devoted to that. We're just going on animated. So you're sticking with what you've got. Pinocchio and the terrifying scene when the boys turn into donkeys.
Even now, it gets under my skin, that scene. And I watch, as you know, a lot of horror films and few get under my skin like that scene does.
Yeah. Okay. So on that note, we will say goodbye and we'll be back next week with more. So for now, Jamie, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
You could say it in your best Deadite way.
Goodbye! I've actually hurt my throat doing that.
Okay. On that note, I'll just say goodbye. Sleep well, listeners.
Ow.
Yeah.